Labour under Jeremy Corbyn was apparently clobbered to death in 2019. What I think, you know, most decent people have been feeling is what a relief it is not to have these cruel, psychopathic government ministers in charge anymore. The post-Brexit Tories who were just sinking to the depths of human depravity in a way that I think the relief that we felt genuinely can be compared to what Americans felt seeing the back of Trump.
Yeah, and we've saw it over here too. Cruella and Sumac, Richie Rich Sumac, and some of these other casts of characters that look like Disney might have drawn them up. While Trump is not the word, you can't say that word right now because you might evoke the witch's return. But as for the total wipeout of the Tories, as you say, that not only was the majority win for Labour achieved with less votes than Corbyn won in either of his outings, but the seat loss for the Tories was immense. They went from 365 seats, like one seat for every day of the year, to 121 seats, which would be May Day, May the 1st, if we're going to stay with this calendrical analogy. So, I mean, this was, as you write in your article, the greatest political wipeout for the party ever in more than 190 years, longer than this colony, former colony Canada, at least former British colony, come American colony Canada, has even been in existence.
Yeah, and I mean, that bit of the story is great, Chris. I mean, they absolutely deserved it. And I really do think it's important for people to recognize that the Tory party, which came in 2010 and was cruel from the word go. I mean, this was the David Cameron and George Osborne government that used the 2008 global crash as an excuse to try and destroy the state provision of services in the UK and introduced a sweeping era of horrible austerity. But, you know, things got even worse after Brexit, which was Cameron's fault. He couldn't be bothered to stand up to the far right. And so he said, we'll have a referendum. And what that ushered in, which I think, you know, I think we'll see more and more clearly as time goes on, is that it not only made racism and xenophobia and anti-immigrant sentiment, it became the kind of primary driver of the people who ended up in charge in these successive governments that we had with unelected leaders. But it also was a time when they genuinely felt that that removing ourselves from the shared laws that we had with the EU for over 40 years meant that really no rules applied. I mean, they treated Britain like a tabula rasa on which they could conduct any experiment that they felt like. And these were, cruel and ungenerous people. So that really was a nightmare. The problem that we have now, of course, is that we've been they're replaced by a centrist or centre-right neoliberal warmongering government that beyond the few things they've done in the first few days, looks like they're destined to be a profound disappointment. So, you know, what they did was they almost immediately dropped the Rwanda plan, which was this cruel and deranged effort by the Tories to send genuine asylum seekers, you know, the refugees to our country, to send them on a one-way trip to Rwanda for the processing of their claims, where if their claim that they were a legitimate refugee in the UK was accepted, they would get a new home in some kind of open prison in Rwanda. That's been dropped. What else have they done? They have dropped the Tories' long-standing ban on wind turbines on the UK mainland. This was a NIMBYist obsession. Do you have that saying in Canada, NIMBY?
Oh, yes.
Not in my backyard. Yeah. So, but that's kind of it. Now it's all the business of saying, you know, we've got no money for anything, and we're only going to be able to repair all this damage with the kind assistance of the private sector. Of course, it's the private sector and the obsession with privatization in the UK for four decades, which has got us into this mess in the first place. So it's not looking great.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, that they didn't bring this in. You mentioned the 14 years of austerity. They just accelerated a program of privatizations, P3s and so forth that Margaret Thatcher pioneered way back when. And you and I are sadly both old enough to remember that firsthand. When you talk about the tabula rasa approach, it reminds actually of Thatcher's pal Pinochet when he ascended power in his own inimitable way in Chile way back when, coming in and making of his country a testing ground for these neoliberal policies. The neoliberalism lives on. The Tories may be gone, but the philosophy remains. I'm fascinated, Andy, by this leader now, Keir Starmer. He, as you say, he's following in the footsteps, and I can't say to be surprised. Anybody that's got a Sir for a first name before their first name, I've got to wonder about their Labour bona fides. But who is Sir Keir, and how is it that he has managed to get himself at the first seat of a Labour Party in Britain?
Well, yes. So, I mean, so the problems here are that, you know, Sir Keir got his title through being the Director of Public Prosecutions, which is essentially the chief prosecutor of the UK. Now, you know, no offence to prosecutors, there are certain cases in which that mentality is necessary for, you know, prosecuting brave wrongdoers. But, you know, instinctively, every aspect of my socialist self would confirm that if you were going to have a lawyer in charge of the country, it should be a really great defense lawyer, not the nation's former chief prosecutor. I mean, this is the man who, after the riots that took place in 2011 in the UK, this was after the police had assassinated a young man called Mark Duggan up in Tottenham in North London. And riots broke out across the country where things were set alight and, you know, I mean, certain buildings were completely destroyed. Mostly it involved people looting, you know, rather sadly, you know, breaking into a sports shop and making off, you know, with a load of trainers. But Keir Starmer was in charge of these 24-hour courts that were established to swiftly, you know, hunt down and prosecute every single person that was involved in, you know, even opportunistically passing by and stealing a bottle of water. You know, to me, that has rather alarming indications of what he will be like in terms of authoritarianism, in terms of his acceptance of protest. It suggests to me that he's this sober, sensible man who has no time for anything that disrupts business as usual. And although we've had, you know, the most horrific clampdowns on protest from the Tories, I'm not feeling in any way certain that it's going to change at all. And this is a time when, you know, the laws that the Tories pass means that if environmental protesters step off the curb of the pavement onto the road to hold a slow march, to disrupt traffic, to highlight the fact that the world as we know it is dying and that our government is failing to fulfill the promises it made at the Paris Agreement in 2015, they can be arrested and they can receive long prison sentences. So, you know, it's not a great place to be in, certainly from a civil liberties point of view. And of course, you know, Starmer also, I think very troublingly, was the main driver in the West of the false and devastating notion that criticism of the state of Israel is equivalent to anti-Semitism. criticism of the state of Israel is that the only government that you're not allowed to criticize because you will then be accused of racism. And as we've seen since October the 7th, this is being used around the world to shut down legitimate criticism of the Israeli government and the genocide that it's undertaking in Gaza. And what it did in the UK was it removed Jeremy Corbyn from power as the leader of the Labour Party. And that was very deliberate. And that was something in which Keir Starmer was very much involved. And so that's also a worry, because, of course, Keir Starmer, who's a trained human rights lawyer, just a few days after Israel began its deadly assault on Gaza, said that Israel had the right to cut off food, water and power to the Palestinian people, which is clearly it did not have that right. It never has that right. That is a grotesque war crime. And so unfortunately, that's the situation that we're in. So on foreign policy, this isn't looking good. He's just flown off to be with all his NATO mates today. So he'll be a fully paid up member of the World War III Putin is the most evil man who ever lived party. And that's without even getting into some of the issues around the domestic disaster that it's going to be if the Labour Party can't find a way of raising money to invest in the appallingly bad rundown state of services in the country.
Yeah, and you talk about that in your article too, and I want to talk about that as well in a second. But if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Andy Worthington. Andy's an English journalist, activist, author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Forefathers Band, as well as being a challenging intro for anybody that can't speak quite as fast as your average auctioneer. He's also the author of the book The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, and the Battle of the Beanfield. I was asked, Andy, specifically, and you mention it in your article, by John Helmer, who lives in England part of the year and has done for many years and was educated there as well. His feels attached, although he's a colonial like myself, he still feels attached to the mothership. He says, well, what about the shit in the water? What about the Thames water? This has been a huge scandal there. When you talk about privatizations and what you call Thatcher's darkest legacy, you mentioned the selling of the water and sewage system to private interests and where that has led. This is something that has come up here in Canada time and again and has mostly been defeated. What's the deal there?
Well, the deal there, this is going to be most interesting, Chris, because, the collapse of the privatized water system is now so extreme that they're claiming that they run out of money. I mean, the background to the story is that when the water companies were privatized in England and Wales in 1989 by Thatcher, they had no debt. They are now burdened with tens of billions of pounds of debt, which the water companies have accrued so that they can pay their shareholders. And they've paid almost the same amount out that they've borrowed in shareholder dividends. And these are, internationally known rapacious, predatory companies. While doing this, of course, they have genuinely, seriously invested almost nothing in maintaining adequate clean water in England and preventing sewage spills into our rivers and our seas. And it is a situation that, many of Britain's other problems are mirrored in other countries where, there's been a rundown of public services because of neoliberalism. But this is the startling example in which England stands alone, having privatized water and literally ending up with us, swimming in shit. Companies are now collapsing. They're saying they're running out of money. They want to raise the bills by 50-60% next year. And the government is having emergency meetings with them where their intention is to try and find a regulatory system that will work. And I mean, who are they kidding?
Wait a minute. You just said that this guy, he had these panels when people were busting windows and stealing trainers. And for our continental or Western, this side of the Atlantic audience, that doesn't mean they're stealing people who train people there. That's like what the English call the things you put on your feet when you want to go jogging. But he can hold these instant legal remedies in that instance, and now he's having sit downs over cucumber sandwiches with the guys that have been raping and pillaging the water and sewage supply.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, that's the big problem, isn't it? If you won't accept that the private sector's only interest in being involved in anything is profit, and that anything else is strictly secondary, then, you know, you really, it seems to me, are unfit for dealing with all the problems that we have, which are caused by four decades of continuous privatization and the raping and pillaging of all our public services.
Was that a part of the election? Was that an election issue, the water issue? And if so, so what has Labour promised during the election to do, and are they moving with speed to expedite their promises?
No. They didn't promise anything. They looked at the bill, and because they don't want to borrow a single penny from anywhere to do anything, then they said no. We're going to get tough on them with regulations. What happened in the election, actually, where the Tories lost something like the Liberal Democrats went from 11 seats to 72 seats. And one of the reasons that they did that was because they took town after town after town in the Tory shires, you know, that have been true blue forever, because one of the main issues for these people who live out in what we city dwellers forget about, the countryside, you know, this is a huge, huge issue for them. And Labour, I don't know what they're going to do. I mean, I understand the problem, Chris, is that this might cost, you know, fill in the blank billions. It might cost £100 billion or more to take water back into public ownership and to deal with these 35 years of horror. But there's no way of regulating private companies, mostly foreign, whose only interest in owning this asset is on how much they can extract from it without actually providing the service.
That's fair enough. I mean, that's what it's all about. But if they're not providing the services that they, you know, promised they would provide when they contracted.
Well, that's a particularly interesting point, isn't it? I mean, at which point... let's take climate. What's starting to happen, and it seems to be happening quite a lot in the States, is that lawyers are coming out with creative cases to try and take the oil companies to court for lying about what they were doing. It seems to me that there must be some clever lawyers around who can start unpicking the problems of privatization when you give or sell cheaply, you know, a company to private predators who then don't do the job that is supposed to be the basis of their profiteering. Surely there's a case to be made, isn't there?
Well, stop calling me Shirley, first of all. And secondly, I would say, chuck somebody in the can. You know, go into one of those board meetings and drag a few of their guys out. Treat them like campers at a university trying to call for peace in the Middle East and show them what's what. I mean, that's the beginning. And then start stripping their assets like you did to the truckers in Canada and so forth. I mean, there are ways. Okay, we don't have left a little bit now. The first past the post system we sadly share with Britain here in Canada, as we do with most of the parliamentary process from the first parliament. They didn't deserve the seats they've got. With you right, the 34% of the popular vote turned into 63% of the seats. It also freezes out smaller parties like the Greens. And Nigel Farage, the guy that was the upset guy, I'm not sure if you think he should have, with 14%, got more, or with 4 million votes, got more or less than 14%. I did notice, though, Andy, that the names of these leaders. And Corbyn, of course, was undone. And I was watching the Labour Files, the excellent Al Jazeera documentary on how Starmer proved to be the Lenin Moreno of Britain, Judas Iscariot, the Brutus to Jeremy Corbyn's Caesar. But I just was looking, Jeremy, Keir, and Nigel. I thought, wow, that looks like one of those English boy bands. And then looking at the turnout for the election, less than 60% of Britons that could vote did vote in this general election. I was thinking, well, if this boy band took it on the road and they could only sell 60% or less of the tickets of every show, they wouldn't last very long at all. But that's just an aside. What I want to talk about, Andy, other than the zingers, is about Corbyn was undone, as you say, by weaponizing anything that we've seen spread farther, but it was really honed in Britain. Now, Keir Starmer, as you said, has signed off as a human rights lawyer on starvation and depriving the people of Gaza of water. Just this morning, the Netanyahu regime said that they were openly going to ethnically cleanse Gaza City in the north of the Gaza Strip. All of what they've done is grossly illegal, of course, over these last almost 9 months. But what about now Britain's position moving forward? We've seen France went actually a little bit left by the looks of it for their elections. And Mélenchon, their maybe prime minister to come or maybe not, has been blistering, saying that they're going to do a lot. Has this new Labour government, Starmer's government, have they made any moves beyond what you mentioned about his past statements on starvation and deprivation of services and water being okay? Have they made any move towards addressing the disaster unfolding in Gaza now?
No, the short answer to that is no. But what's interesting, Chris, is that there was a longstanding, senior member of the Labour Party, Emily Thornberry, who was supposed to be made the Attorney General. And what Starmer did was that he actually appointed from outside a longstanding, respected international human rights lawyer, happens to be Jewish, who took the exact opposite position to the one that I mentioned that Keir Starmer took back in October.
I lost you, Andy.
Oh, yeah, you've been cutting out a bit as well, Chris. Can you hear me?
Okay, sorry, Andy. It looks like we had a little bit of a technical glitch there, and for those listening, you might have noticed we've dropped out a little bit. Can you pick that up again? He was, and briefly, because I want to get to the Guantanamo, Israel's Guantanamo, too, but in the last 4 minutes or so we got. But can you pick up your thread?
Yeah, so Starmer appointed an internationally respected human rights lawyer to be the Attorney General. So the person responsible for giving legal advice to the government. This man is Jewish, but he is also and has been for a long time critical of Israel's occupation of Palestine. And just a few weeks into Israel's genocide in Gaza, he was talking about how it was almost unimaginable for the siege conditions that that Israel was imposing on the Gaza Strip to be in any way conforming to international humanitarian law. So it's interesting that he's put somebody in a post who will tell him that he needs to be critical of Israel. What I wonder is whether the Attorney General provides the information to him, whether he wants it or not, or whether it's only when he's asked that he will come up with this. But I can't understand why this has happened if Starmer isn't aware of the significance of it. There's no way that he would not be aware of it. What does it mean? And I just don't know that yet. He's done nothing. He, deplored the Russian attack on the school yesterday. He's been absolutely silent on Gaza.
Well, and the Russian attack wasn't an attack, and we're not even sure, I think, even yet, despite Bellingcat's assertions.
Well, obviously. Obviously, Chris, yeah.
of whose, you know, missile hit what. And at any rate, it's nothing compared to what's going on in Israel. And what's going on in Israel, you posted up on Twitter today a picture and a post about this unfortunate Moazzaz Obayat, a Palestinian bloke who's been held almost, I think, even before October 7th. They released this guy, as they've done a few others, and didn't shoot him or drop bombs on him like they did a few other releases a few days ago. But this guy was a walking wreck, or hardly walking wreck, after his stay in the prison system in the Negev. I've done shows about the Sde Tamein, the prison there that is being called Israel's Guantanamo. What can you say in the last 2 minutes or so about that, Andy?
Well, I'd just say that it's worse, Chris. So I'll say that the randomness of, you know, destroying international law in the way that, you know, we see at Guantanamo, where people are held indefinitely without charge or trial. Israel's system is arbitrary. It always has been. So people are arbitrarily rounded up, and then they are sometimes arbitrarily released. It's almost as though they're doing that deliberately to stick two fingers up to the international rules. They don't charge people, or if they do charge people, quite often they do it with administrative detention, which is definitely something that was copied at Guantanamo, because it allows you to hold people indefinitely without charge or trial. But I think the things that I've been seeing that show that this is a situation that's way more horrific, dare I say, than Guantanamo, is they hold people in absolute immobility and silence. I mean, like for months after months. You know, and if they infringe that, then they, you know, they get the crap beaten out of them. They're hauled off whenever they feel like it for interrogations, in inverted commas, which may lead to them dying. But what my understanding of everything that America did after 9/11 is that they tried that from the moment they rounded people up in Bagram and were holding them. And what happened is that the prisoners revolted. The prisoners always fought back. They always fought back about their right to pray, if nothing else. And, you know, and that was hugely significant. And it was hugely significant that the Americans, although in response to those, you know, reacted with extreme brutality, and that we could possibly see that some of the unexplained deaths at Guantanamo related to people who were particularly ferocious resistors of this. They didn't undertake the kind of repression that Israel does. I mean, forcing people to never move, to never talk to the people next to them, to be unable as Muslims to pray at all, is just, it's like something I've never heard before, Chris. And I think it's just, it's yet another sign of the absolute barbarity and depravity of the Israeli regime. You know, everywhere that we look, the things that they do, they are doing on a scale and to an extent that that it just absolutely shocks the conscience every day.
Well, depravity sums it up, and it's not just theirs, of course. It's ours who sit and watch and allow this continue. Andy Worthington, thanks a lot for coming on again, Andy. AndyWorthington.co.uk. I look forward to our next chat, and I thank also John Helmer for coming on. That's all I've got for this week. I see I got it in before you did. Till the next time, Andy.
Thanks so much, Chris. Bye.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Online at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
Coco.
And I'm DJ Star.
Come join us for Slumber Party, Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
You'll hear female artists, oversharing, and research on health, psychology, and identity.
Hope to see you there.
Hey, This is Anuki, your Faculty of Environment representative, here to let you know what the SFSS is. The SFSS is a student union that is student-led, and it represents and advocates for the interests of the 26,000 undergraduate students at SFU. We are a non-for-profit support network and a voice at SFU, which provides services like the UCAS and health and dental. We also provide support to make your student life better. You can reach the SFSS on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or by emailing us. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you.